Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
I'm Kaylee Cuoco.
I'm Eli Roth.
This is Marlon Wayans.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
All right, I'm here with Marty Bowen. By the way, for people listening right now that we're starting, this is now the eighth time we've tried to start this conversation. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Todd.
How are you feeling, brother?
I feel pretty much almost back to normal. I'm a little tired, a little more than I want to, but otherwise I'm great.
For people who don't know, you actually tested for the COVID virus. So are you in the attic that you quarantined yourself in?
Yes, I'm back in the attic, sadly, to make this phone call because it's the only place in my house that actually the phone works normally.
I do not mean to laugh. I'm taking this very seriously. How was it? Tell me what happened. Like, where do you think you got it? What were the symptoms? Walk me through the whole thing.
So about 3 weeks ago, on a Tuesday, I was coming from a meeting at STX, and my wife had scheduled a 7 o'clock massage for me because I had woken up feeling very sore and just assumed that had something to do with exercise. I don't know why, because I don't work out that hard. But in any case, I'm assuming I'm busting my ass and it's all this, shit going on in my body. In any case, I've come back from the meeting and the woman's there and I'm telling my wife, it's like, I'm so sore. And it's freaking cold around here. And so they turned the temperature up in the in our bedroom. And by the time I finished my massage and I looked back up at the woman who was massaging me, she was wearing a mouthpiece thing.
Oh no.
Like covering her face. And I was like, well, that's strange. Maybe she's taking this whole COVID thing a little seriously. And it's certainly early in the process. So I go to take a shower. And when I get out of the shower, my wife is sitting there and she said, Marty, the massage therapist says you have a very high temperature. And so she had the thermometer and I'm like, oh, okay. And I tried the thermometer and I was 103.
Whoa. Wow.
And had no idea. So I then got sent up to the attic. We all started to panic that it was the COVID 19 virus. And the next day, because through circumstances, I actually fired my doctor. Only I can figure out how to fire a doctor before a pandemic happens. And so my wife called the pediatrician and the pediatrician said, oh, sounds like he's got some of the symptoms. Have him drive by my office and I can swab what I thought was going to be his mouth. And when I closed my eyes and opened my mouth, he shoved that thing up the top of my nose.
Oh,
which
gosh.
Was terrifying. Oh, it was great.
Oh gosh.
And so I then did that, came back to the house. I took Tylenol and Mucinex or Mucinex, however you pronounce it. And over the next 2 or 3 days, I felt like I had a cold or a low grade flu, but it wasn't too terribly bad. And by the time I got back the results, I kind of felt like I was fine, but the results for you had, I had the virus.
Wow.
And then, so I basically stayed in my attic for the next 2 weeks as everybody was freaking out. Got a call back from the nurse at the Department of Health assigned to me basically saying, well, if you haven't exhibited any symptoms in such and such a period of time, you're fine. And so I actually put on my Instagram, hey, I'm fine. They told me I'm okay because I didn't want people to worry about me. I'd gotten way too much free food sent to the house.
Right.
And then 2 days, I got right back to work, got back on the treadmill. 2 days later, I'm like, oh, I feel this symptom again. I remember this.
Wow.
And so I went back up to the attic and was there for about 2 days. And I finally just went to my wife. None of my kids or my wife had gotten the virus. And I said, I got to get out of here. There's no sense being in the attic cooped up here. And you've got 3 mouths to feed and no one to help you. I'm checking out and going to Oxnard. And so that's what I did. I went to the beach I went to the beach and then a couple of days into it, I got another test. And then on 2 days ago, I got cleared.
So, and nobody else in your family got it.
Mm-mm. But here's the thing. My wife thinks, and I think we're going to find out that this is true, but my wife thinks that she got the virus in January. All these articles saying that Chinese tourists came in here as early as the middle of 2019 infected. And that's why, and again, I'm clearly not an expert in pandemics, but that's why that our curve is flattening faster than what they think New York's was.
Can I tell you, I was supposed to go to New York the middle to end of January, and I got a high fever, dry cough for 3 or 4 days and thought, oh man, I got pneumonia or something. Went to my doctor and he goes, I don't know, man. I can't, it's not the flu. I don't know what this is. And didn't, you know, we didn't know. It was pre all the knowledge of it. And then he gave me codeine cough syrup, which, you know, suppressed the cough. And then I kept for a week after, no joking. No, it suppressed the cough. And then now that I've heard everybody's symptoms, I think for sure. So we're going to actually have the antibody test because I feel like it's irresponsible not to. And we should just try to get as much information as we can, even though who knows how reliable those tests are. But at least I feel like if we can start to piece the pieces together, it's got to be helpful. I mean, knowledge is at least helpful, if nothing else. And so, well, thank God you're okay, man. I'm sorry. Do you have any idea where you might have got it? I mean, you travel so much,
Just for your audience, I just need to make sure. Are you wearing top to bottom Mortal Kombat swag?
Yes. Here's why. First of all, yes, I am wearing top to bottom Mortal Kombat swag. And the reason why is I literally got up and I started where I'm. What's insane, I'm sure you're feeling the same way, is I'm more busy now than I was when I was shooting my movie. It's so, because we're trying to get everything finished. We're in the middle of, you know, finishing to deliver to the studio the cut for this movie All My Life that we did for Universal, and it's pencils down literally today at 2 p.m. I've been up since 6 a.m. and I was cold, so I put on my hoodie that was given to me by one of our fantastic actors on the movie, and then Joe Taslim.
Was that actor's name Ed Hardy?
No, that's Lin Kuei. This is Lin Kuei logo, and that was given to me by the gentleman who's playing Sub-Zero in our movie. And then my hat is because I was supposed to do Skype with you, which wasn't going to be video, and then you just insisted on Zoom. So I go, he's going to see. So I just grabbed the first hat, and then just as you said, it looked in my own reflection, went, I am that guy. I have become the guy that wears my own swag all day. Together. So yes, I am wearing Mortal Kombat swag.
For the audience that wants another picture, he's got nunchucks framed behind him at the
I don't know. So no, I do not. No, I do not. So walk me through what you were in the middle of when this whole thing hit.
We were in the middle of just in terms of the work we were doing.
Yeah. And by the way, let me just say because you keep saying my audience, I fucking love Dave so much. I love your show so much. I can't tell you. I love it so much. And the reason I know, because I wake up in the middle of the night so mad that you made it.
We'll tell that story at another time. And then you'll understand how luck and opportunity get combined.
Oh, I told it. I told it in a story already. I already know.
Oh, did you?
Wick told me the whole thing. And we can talk about it on here too, in case somebody didn't hear it. But the bile that comes up in my throat every time I see one of those episodes, because I love it so much. It's so great, bud. Seriously, congratulations. So you have something on in the pandemic too, by the way, that's crushing for FX. It's so great. So anyway, so congratulations on that. Sorry to interrupt you, but I know you have that. That didn't get interrupted. That is something that's actually out in the world.
Yes, but we were still finishing that up. We're on like the 10th, you know, we're finishing off the last episodes editorially, 9 to 10. We were about a week away from shooting some additional photography for this Sony Kevin Hart movie, Fatherhood, that we were doing. We are in post on two movies, another movie for TriStar called Happiest Season, and another movie for Netflix that we were also in called Sort of Like a Rockstar. All of them were in different places. And then we were in pre-production, just finishing off some casting for this movie we're doing for Paramount, and then shit hit the fan.
Well, let's talk about the post stuff. So what we did was we had set, so I have two movies in post and a TV series in post, and the movies in post, one the is in Australia, and the editor, we were already making an editor change, and he had all this stuff on his computer, and so he's just been working via the computer. So he's actually been turning reels over because he's just been by himself at his house, been amazing. The other one, the Universal one, we moved him to Palm Springs because he has grandkids there, and he wanted to make sure he could be helpful with them, and he had a setup in Palm Springs, but because Universal is feeling like, you know, they're furloughing people and people, a lot of people aren't working, that everybody needed to stop. So we're actually stopping today, which is a Friday, working. And then weirdly, I have a Netflix TV show with Bert Kreischer that we were seconds away from finishing. And we actually, I mean, who knows if it's actually going to make it into the final product, but we actually had some FaceTime things that Bert was supposed to be doing with his wife. It's part of the show. We did them on an iPhone.
That's great.
We'll Why see. Not? We turned it in. I think it's kind of cool because it kind of lends to the verisimilitude of the movie, I mean, the TV show. But who knows if Netflix will allow actually iPhone footage to be used.
Some people are able to do some of their post stuff over all these apps, and then other people are pencils down for a little bit. Like for us on the Sony movie, and we really were done, except we went and did a couple of things extra for the movie with Kevin Hart. So we're just not locking it. We're going to just sit back and wait till it changes. And obviously as we get closer to release dates, which in case anybody doesn't realize that they're moving all over the place right now. And we got moved forward, but we still feel like we have enough time to get it done before our release date.
Well, I mean, that's the hard part. You're at the hard part now with this pandemic, because you're at the part where now with, okay, well, now what? Now, how are you going to preview, right? How you don't have an audience. So, I mean, you can't put an audience together right now. So what are you going to do? Has anybody even thought of that? Like,
well, we can't shoot. We've already previewed before. A couple of times. But we can't preview the new footage, obviously, until we get a chance to do that.
Right. I had Kevin Getz on the first iteration of this podcast, and I know because I've been talking to him, because I have a project with him. He's completely revamping Screen Engine to do stuff on streaming, you know, what the people are viewing right now. I mean, he's been jamming, trying to figure this whole thing out. Are the new viewing habits given this current situation and going forward?
Well, how about us? I can honestly tell you that, like, a couple of weeks ago, UTA kept trying to get me in a meeting over Skype or Zoom with DJ Khaled. And I'm like, well, I'd love to meet him. I'm really interested. I saw him in Bad Boys. I thought he was actually pretty good in his scene. But it just seems weird to talk to somebody and look at them at the same time. I'm not altogether comfortable with it. But within a week or so of really kind of being back in the mix, it's not comfortable not to do it that way. Like every single call I have to email and say, is this a voice call or is this an audio call? Or I didn't know what a VC was. VC's changed now. So I now say, or I say AVO, audio call only. It's just so confusing.
But by the way, the reason why we're Zooming right now is you and I spent 20 minutes trying to figure out, without any assistance at our houses, trying to figure out how to do this and ended up, which is why I'm in head to toe Mortal Kombat swag.
For the record, Skype is not yet idiot proof.
we could not figure that out. So then tell me about the movie and pre-production, because that is fascinating to me, because I mean, I've talked pretty extensively on this already about my experience. I was in production on a couple things, and just the scariness of dealing with the people and making sure they were safe and getting them all home. But I didn't have anything in pre-production. What are they saying to you? How are you feeling about that now? Because you're now being pushed back by anything your actors were in currently or previously, right? I mean, we're in, and are you so pot committed that you think that they're going to keep going through with it, or what is the vibe?
Well, we lost our lead actor because of this, because we were trying to fulfill a slot. And the reality is that slot is going to be taken over by the virus and pushing off another commitment he already had. So we're in the middle of this right now, trying to find new actor for our lead.
Right.
And I mean, the good news, and I tend to be an optimist.
Me too. That's all we can be.
Yeah.
I keep saying that to people, because like Ben Fritz came on and said, it's going to be a second wave, the Spanish flu of 1918, all this stuff. And I'm like, I'm a 50-year-old movie producer, man. If I don't just live in denial and optimism, I'll be dead. So yeah. I have to just pretend, yeah, once this thing's over, it's all going to go back to normal. In fact, it's going to be even better.
I think the movies that they can get up and running as quickly as possible are the ones that, you know, are in good shape. And this is not a big budgeted film. And it doesn't, you know, doesn't need Tom Cruise to be the star. So from that perspective, I think we stand a pretty good chance of getting things up and running quickly.
And what do you feel, because you're in it, I mean, and you're, you know, we do these, you and I and Bo and Richard Brenner and Sean Bailey and Gordon Gray and Scott Greenberg and a bunch of guys do these Zoom happy hours on, is it tonight? Yeah, right, on Fridays. And so I kind of have, you know, I think people are a little bit more tentative around me because they know that I'll talk about it on this thing. But you have your ear to the ground. What do you think is going to happen when this thing's over? Like, what are you preparing for post-pandemic for your company?
I don't think we have a clear sense of what's going to happen. I think anybody looking at a crystal ball is going to be mistaken. I think our viewing habits are going to rapidly change for people. Even our communicating habits are rapidly changing. So I can't speak to which platform is going to win at what point. I know that Netflix's subscription rate has gone up and Disney's has gone up and theatrical is changing as we speak, but we've kind of already been living through that. And whether it accelerates the death of theatrical, I don't know. What I do know is that audiences are still wanting to consume entertainment voraciously. And so whether it's film or television, theatrical or streaming, I just still got to push rocks up hills.
Well, speaking about how voraciously I've been consuming content, I watched Adaptation last night. God damn, that movie's good. And if people don't know, in your former life, you represented Charlie Kaufman and yes. helped put that movie together. And in fact, if anybody wants to, should watch that movie, because there is a fairly accurate representation of you in that movie, played by the great Ron.
There's some dialogue that's questionable.
Hey, I don't know. Played by the great Ron Livingston. Man, you're going to sell me out for my Mortal Kombat swag. I'll sell you out for your UTA your UTA talent days. God, what a great movie. And the only reason why I was saying that, besides to bust you, Ron's interpretation of you, was, yeah, man, do you think you could get that movie made today? I mean, you might be able to because you make these cool things, but f***ing A, man, that movie breaks third, fourth, fifth wall, comes back around. You know, it's half documentary. Yeah. I mean, well, I know it's true. I know that the whole thing was he tried to adapt that book and then, you know, couldn't do it. And then started going down the rabbit hole of what if I just put myself in it and my fictitious twin brother and do that. And then getting Robert McKee. I mean, it's just, anybody who has not watched that movie in a long time or has not watched that movie, besides the fact that Ron Livingston does a great Marty Bowen impression, it is such a remarkable movie and tragically doesn't feel like something we could get made today. So just besides just talking about how much voraciously we're consuming content, how did you get that movie made?
You're giving me far too much credit. The truth was, at that point, Charlie was, even though I guess he'd had, I mean, he was the Preston Sturges of the 90s, you know. I mean, he had been nominated for being John Malkovich. He had had Confessions of a Dangerous Mind made. He had had Human Nature made, and people had read all of his material. So he was that guy that was going to do something that you didn't expect, but you were, as long as he didn't lose his mind in the process, you were going to be excited to get something that no one else was writing. And that's what ended up happening, is that he ended up writing something that nobody expected. But while he was doing that, Being John Malkovich was coming out and it was getting nominated. And so when Spike read Adaptation, none of which, I mean, nobody knew that that's what he was writing. When Spike got that, he's like, I love this. I want to do it. And then it was a question of, could you get an actor with enough juice to justify making it a studio? And the next thing we got was Nicolas Cage. So Getting Being John Malkovich made was far more challenging, but getting Adaptation was not as bad as you might think.
So for real, was what studio was it again?
Sony. Columbia.
Was it Amy at the time, Pascal?
Mm-hmm.
Was she waiting for a legit adaptation of The Orchid Thief?
Yes.
Wow. That must
and
have been
forever. But we all kind of knew he was having a difficult time. What's interesting to note for the writers that are listening, for the two writers that are listening to the show, what's interesting to note is that he struggled. And if anything is inaccurate in the story in terms of his process, he is the agent represented by Ron Livingston, Marty Bowen, in the movie says, if you don't do this, if you don't turn this in, it's going to destroy your career. And in fact, although it's not as dramatic, my advice was the complete opposite, because he needed to know that it was okay to fail. And you know, you have three or four scripts that everybody loves from an agent's perspective. I know I can sell him off of his momentum and his talent. But I also recognize that not everybody hits a home run when they get up to bat. And so I was like, that's okay. Don't beat yourself up. Just turn it in and we'll figure it out.
Man, it's such a good, I mean, it's really, I had seen it a couple of times, but last night was like really, really needed, because just of what we're all going through and being stuck and being kind of creatively stuck right now in terms of, you know, not literally not being able to go outside. It was a perfect, perfect movie to watch. And by the way, have you seen the Dana Carvey documentary, the Dana Carvey Show documentary?
Loved
it. It's amazing. If anybody hasn't seen it, it's on Hulu. It is the making of the Dana Carvey Show. It's a fantastic documentary, because at that moment in time, he had all of the best comic voices that you could possibly have, including Charlie Kaufman, on his writing staff and in his show. He had Steve Carell, he had Steve Colbert, he had Smigel, he had Charlie Kaufman, he had Spike Feuerstein. I mean, it just was so many incredible, incredible writers, you know, being led by Smigel, and just exactly like you're saying, just getting lost and going a complete way that just the network did not want, but doing things that were true to themselves and true to their own art. And I think now, given, this is why I was wanted to lead you here, is I've been saying now, just people stuck in their houses, left to their own devices, I think we're going to have more of those kind of scripts and projects popping out of this, because nobody's writing, you know, the sequel to Milan right now. I mean, probably, I mean, you know, there's nobody has IP. We're all just sort of stuck waiting. So people are just going to hopefully be writing stuff like Adaptation, like cool, or stuff like Dave, like just cool, cool personal movies and television, I hope. And I think if there's enough of them, there's more chance that guys like us can get it made.
Well, speaking to the producers on this podcast, I do think, you know, you get to those places in development of a project where it might be a small, intimate project that you really love, but you know to get it set up to get the writer paid is going to be a challenge. I mean, this is a good time and a good excuse to go back to the writer and go, look, I'd love to try to sell it, but you're kind of better off trying to get it written instead of trying to go into a Zoom pitch.
Well, tell us then now how you got Dave made.
Okay. I will.
And it's fine. And it's fine that it is a Marty Bowen story where you have a gold bar shoved up your ass and you get lucky, because I know that you say that all the time, but you have consistently been in the right place to have these wonderful things happen. And it's a testament to you, who you are as a producer and who you were as an agent, that you are so talent friendly, that people send people like DJ Khaled and Dave to you and Scooter Braun to you. So I know you're going to be super self-effacing right now, but I'm telling you, even though it came together in a miraculous way, it's a great story for people that are in the business, because you have to put yourself in those positions to be able to have good shit happen to you.
Well, and I can only speak to it from my perspective, because if you look at the executive producer list, it's a long list on the show. But bottom line is my former partner, Wick Godfrey, and I wanted to do kind of an Idlemaker, a modern day Idlemaker story. And of course, we were fascinated with Scooter Braun, the rags to riches tale of a young guy in Atlanta who manages to get immersed into the hip hop world and then goes on to sign the biggest pop star in the world. That was intriguing to us, and we found him to be very interesting. And we knew that he had wanted to get into the film world a lot. And so we scheduled a meeting to sit down with him so that we could kind of get his rights, hear his story, and use Scooter Braun as an entity to help us put together what we thought would be a really interesting window and perspective into modern music. And while we were there, Scooter was so excited about one of his clients, his development clients, this guy Lil Dicky, and I had never heard of Lil Dicky, but he put him on the TV. We giggled our asses off at what we saw. We all thought it was incredibly clever. And he said, I said, well, why are you showing this? He goes, maybe you guys can help us. And I go, well, what are you looking to do? And he said, well, we're trying to do a kind of a Curb Your Enthusiasm that was to, and do kind of Lil Dicky's story, trying to get into the hip hop world. And I'm like, oh, that sounds really cool. I go, have you tried to get Jeff Schaefer yet? And he goes, Jeff Schaefer. I mean, he was the first person I was thinking of because Jeff was the showrunner of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and he also did The League. And
you used to represent him, correct?
Correct. And they said, and I went to college with him, and they said, he said, yeah, I've been trying to get into room forever. And I go, oh, well, I'll take care of that for you. Because they had been, you know, agents had said he's not available. And that's right. Probably true. Jeff is eternally not available. What they don't know about Jeff is when he loves something, he just loves it. And he approaches everything with complete enthusiasm. So he's the guy that's more likely to get himself in trouble trying to do 80 things at once. And at the very least, I thought it might be interesting to make a mitzvah there, you know? Scooter wants to meet Jeff. I think I can get Jeff to meet Scooter because I think that's interesting enough. And so I called Jeff. I said, I want you to do this. I said he wants to talk about this project. Let's think about it. I go, why don't you watch some of it? And he and I both started watching it. We were kind of texting and, you know, thinking it was really funny. And there was a possibility that I was not even going to be able to go to that meeting that day, because I had something else going on where he was going to meet Scooter. Just Jeff was going to meet Scooter basically on a general basis. And then it was raining really hard. The other meeting got canceled at 11th hour. I was like, I'm not going to let Jeff go to this thing by himself. I'm going to go to the meeting and sort of make sure that it all goes well. I get to the meeting where they're 10 minutes early, just they're 10 minutes early. It's raining cats and dogs. And I sit in Jeff's car and we're talking. He's like, Marty, this is really good. And I'm like, yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah, it's really good. And wow. We go into Scooter's office, and in the room, he had, without telling us, he had brought Lil Dicky.
Wow.
And Lil Dicky was in the room, and Jeff and Lil Dicky fought for about an hour. The Scooter and I and his group around him, we were all dying laughing because it was so interesting to see that very unusual dynamic at play. But what we all knew in that moment was there was real magic there. And wow. Jeff decided he wanted to do it. We then put together our pitch. We went to every buyer. Every buyer made us an offer.
Wow. That's so great.
Every buyer made us an offer. And they were, you know, different platforms had different potential. And we ultimately, because of The League and because of Landgraf and because of what we felt like was the right decision at the time, and the world has changed since then, we went with a deal that had sort of less teeth, frankly, at FX, but we went with the place that felt like made the most sense creatively for Jeff and Dave.
It's a great story for so many reasons, and that is true producing. And it, again, I say, it's a testament to being able to get say the right guy that they had already been thinking of, be able to, in your head, put these sensibilities together, get the guy on the phone, be there in the meeting. I mean, it. You produced it. That's f-ing great. You deserve it. It still doesn't make me want to punch you any less because I'm jealous as hell because I love that show. But congratulations, man. I know I've been sending you tons of texts congratulating you through this whole COVID quarantine thing, but it's so great. And so
those of you that you haven't seen episode 3, I just want to say this. Whatever you watch in the first 2 minutes, give it a beat. It comes full circle.
It's So great. Episode 5 was one of the most sublime things I've ever seen. It was just, it's just a great show. And I'll tell you, it's testament to you too, because what I did is I saw Little Dicky. I've known about him forever. I went after him hard after that Chris Brown Freaky Friday video. And I went to Paramount and said, this guy, we got to do something with him. We could do like a Freaky Friday thing with him, just a crazy Freaky Friday thing. Not one of them. And but I didn't get it to Wick, which I should have, now that I'm pissed at myself because he would have known him. Not one of them were like, yeah, this is great. They were like, what the f*** is wrong with you? Who is this? What? He's funny, but that's not a movie. And I'm like, ah, oh,
we tried to get him in Uncle Drew. And by the time that video had come out, we had sold that project, believe it or not.
Oh man, it's great. And I'm actually working with Rel now on this movie that we got shut down. He's awesome. Having a really good time with him. So tell me about your days. Tell me about keeping Temple Hill running while this thing is going on. How are you doing it? How are you actually day-to-day functioning with your staff and keeping your projects moving forward during this time where you're in your attic?
Well, we continue to have our weekly meetings, you know, so we have a TV department meeting, we have publishing meeting, we have a film division, we have a general weekend read meeting. So we're doing a lot of that stuff. And I've kind of, because Temple Hill's a group of us, frankly, I kind of have encouraged everybody to communicate aggressively. So CCs, what have you. On a lot of emails and kind of pushing people to keep them active whenever possible. So we're doing more of that kind of communicating than we are through phone, and just trying. The most important thing from my perspective is try not to let inertia set in, because I you know, we are going to go back at some point and things are going to have to get done. And those that are not pushing rocks up the hill now are going to be that much more behind when things get going. And the one good news is it's not like writers, directors, and actors have much else to do. So This is a time to do some heavy development.
And how are you doing that development?
I'm reading books. You know, there's the books that I'm supposed to have read right before. And I was finishing one book that I loved. And so it's got a British element to it. So I'm sending emails to British writers and coming up with lists, sending out, just doing a lot of that. Nothing terribly fancy. It's just the same thing that you've been doing. You know, I get the new Stephen King books in. And so one of them is based on our show, The Outsider. But the other three are available for those of you that are listening. I hope this podcast goes on, like gets produced 6 weeks from now. But looking at it, trying to figure out if there's a way to put it together. And so from that perspective, we've always stayed very, very active in terms of what's a good idea. At what point we've actually sold, you know, we sold a project. I think we may have sold two projects in the time that we've been here in television. So
was that stuff that was already in the works, or stuff that kind of came about after the fact?
Most of it's in the works.
Okay.
Most of it's in the works. But again, you don't just sit back and do nothing because somebody else is filling that gap. You know, we set up a movie at Netflix. So.
And how in the publishing world, how are you finding that? And how has it changed since you guys started this publishing company? Because I think you started that a couple of years ago, right? Or maybe even longer. And how have you found it's kind of evolving? And especially now, you know, with this thing happening, what are you finding in the publishing world?
You mean in terms of books that are sent to us or books that we are sort of packaging?
Both. And aren't you publishing books also?
Yeah.
All three.
So we're in various modes of development on those. 2 days ago, one of our books that we sold to Netflix, that's a love story that I had come up with a few years back. Netflix wants to make it into a movie, and it's been a big successful book, particularly in Europe. And yesterday, 2 days ago or so, it was a clue on Jeopardy.
Oh, that's awesome. I saw you post on that. How did you come up with the idea for that?
It was back when we were thinking that the young adult world was going to pivot, and we were finding it was more and more romantic stuff. And I had, it's a long story, but I had an idea to re-look at sort of a love story paradigm. But instead of putting it at Harvard, I thought I would put it at Oxford. And instead of having it be from the perspective of a, you know, a guy who found a girl from the opposite side of the tracks. We flip-flopped that a little bit and just kind of did our own version of it. And, you know, and then we found writers that were interested. And then ultimately our novelist had done exactly that in Europe, I mean, at Oxford. So just kind of, again, just stirring the pot and good stuff happens.
And then you just, and then when you have that book after you've had it published, you're just sending that book out, or do you then further package it with a writer or director before you take it out?
It, every situation is different. You know, we packaged it. We've almost made this movie twice before. So, you know how it is. I mean, I've had budgets and boards and things like that. So, we just sort of went back to the well.
And then in terms of just keeping in touch with your execs and stuff, mostly just Zoom meetings or just reaching out through email, or how are you finding you're staying connected to the business at large?
It's a combination of that for sure. You know, some I'm talking to every day, some I'm talking to less, but it's literally whenever, it's for me, once I'm home with three young kids, it's very hard to speak on a phone. I've never been that guy, even when I was an agent, that at 9 o'clock, oh my God, you know, Charlie Kaufman's on the phone. I didn't pick that call up. I'd be like, no, I'm good. my day starts when I leave the office and the time it takes to get to my house.
Right.
And I've always been that guy. So it's harder for me to do that. But what I do in its place, I'm like, oh, those books that I give a half a read to, I give a deeper read to, and find myself getting, you know, it's funny. I love fine bindings, like books that were bound in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. And so I'm always in contact with sellers for them. And one of them was reaching out to me, asking me how I was doing. And I said I was great. And she mentioned a movie that she loved in conversation. And I said, you should watch Sweet Smell of Success, one of my favorites. And she in turn said, you need to watch this movie. And I'm like, oh, well, I'll watch that movie. And as I watched the movie, that's a famous movie to some degree that many of us probably have never seen, I realized, oh, there's a way to redo that movie, or at least use the paradigm of that movie to do elsewhere and sort of do an update, because it just kind of works, even though it was from 1951. And so now I'm sending out emails trying to find people that might be right to do that. And I may have sent like 8 emails out because Marjorie sent me an idea.
Your old literature bookbinder lady. It's just the greatest producing story I've ever heard. Where'd you get the idea? Well, I'm into old bound books, and there's a dealer. There's a dealer for that. So, you know, I take her ideas and I go make movies.
There's a beautiful woman behind you who's coming in to offer you.
That's just the nice thing about speaking of the pandemic. I took a spec out and it didn't end up selling. And I just got a nice bottle of tequila for believing in the writer, even though unfortunately it didn't sell at this time. It's too similar to a bunch of stuff that's out there. So let me ask you a question. What have you learned being a producer from being an agent? How has your job shifted in terms of when you obviously are very well read, very smart. You have great instincts. You had great talent relationships. You, despite Ron Livingston's portrayal of you, had very fancy clients. So tell me how being an agent has helped you in doing your job now, just in terms of dealing with writers and talent and how you have adopted, you know, knowing that you've been on the other side of, you know, like you say, Charlie Kaufman being insecure and coming to you and saying, oh, I'm stuck. And you saying, you need to experience failure. As a producer, how has that helped you? And like for other producers out there who weren't agents, what can we glean from those skills that can make us better producers?
Well, I like to use sporting metaphors as much as I possibly can. So I will do it now. And to make it more specific, Todd, I ask you, which sport you would like me to use to answer this question?
Well, because in adaptation, there is a football directly over your right shoulder in the movie, football, Marty.
Okay, Bella. Great. In order to be a good football player, no matter what position, for the most part that you are on, for 90% of the positions, you have to be able to run, tackle, or catch. Sometimes you have to be able to throw, but essentially you have some fundamental athletic ability that you hone in certain ways that makes you better at being a left tackle than a left defensive end, right? And depend if you're on offense or defense, you kind of have percentage differences of those skills. And if you have to switch the ball, you generally can do that sort of thing. And so I would say that whether you're a producer or a studio executive or an agent, you have to have certain skills. You have to have taste. You have to have conviction. You have to be able to sell. And all of those things are required no matter what job you're doing. So the thing that, you know, I felt like helped me as an agent, I was a hustler as an agent. And I always felt like that was the thing that defined me as an agent because I wasn't a cinephile, like I said on your last podcast. And I didn't know I'm only now watching all the Billy Wilder movies and loving it. And so I just assumed I'd be more tenacious because that's what always had done well for me in life. And I hated to read. I read for fun, but I hated to read for work because it didn't hit those juices. It always felt like a job to me. So if I read something, Charlie Kaufman being a great indicator, if I read some, despite the fact that it would not normally be the thing you would think I would like, I was more of a diehard fan than a Sex, Lies, and Videotape fan. If it compelled me to continue to read and get excited, then that was my sort of litmus test. And so taste was something that I didn't expect, but I think like I had, I thought that I had. But the thing that really agents know is they know what they can sell. So if I'm in a staff meeting and someone tells me the story of a 17th century a woman whose feet were bound, but she managed to swim across, you know, the Gulf of Mexico or whatever, I don't know if that idea is necessarily going to find an audience, right? I'm not looking for the next Jim Jarmusch movie. So I can at least sense like, okay, what does my spidey sense tell me in terms of what I can sell and where I can sell it?
And so what does it mean to you when you say you're a hustler as an agent?
I think all agents need to be a hustler. I think, you know, like, look, I remember being in a Pee Wee football as an 8 or 9 year old. And we had to do, we had to sell tickets to a pancake breakfast. And I was competitive. I wanted to sell the most tickets. And I went door to door in my neighborhood as much as I could to sell the most tickets. Now, I don't remember how many tickets I ultimately sold, but I knew that I took it very seriously. And I always, from that moment on, I've always been someone who wanted to do well at that. And, you know, look, I waited tables where you got bonuses if you sold certain dishes over other dishes. I sold jewelry in high school, and you got bonuses, you know, you got a piece of what you sold. So I've always sort of been that guy. And, you know, look, I was never the smartest kid. I was never the fastest kid. I'm certainly not the most athletic kid, but I did well in school and in athletics, I think primarily because I gave a little more effort.
And speaking of giving effort, what are you doing in this time where you're self-quarantined to keep your creative juices flowing? How are you sparking that flame?
Right now, the thing that I'm most interested in getting back to, so I'm reading a book based on a TV show that I'm trying to be the producer on that takes place in my hometown. And I'm reading all the books I can on that. I told you that I started to watch a lot of Billy Wilder. And so I'm watching at least one Billy Wilder movie a day. And I'm reading the Cameron Crowe interview for him from 1998. And I've always been a fan of the history of film. So for me, by going down that road, ideas start to click. Oh, I connect dots. Oh, that's a good idea. What if we did that kind of idea in this sort of world? And then I spitball it out there.
That's cool. Liz Raposa, who is the president of Paramount, did something very cool on the Paramount.com website. If anybody's interested, speaking of Billy Wilder and Sunset Boulevard, is that she had she has listed all of her favorite all of their favorite movies, and kind of curated this very cool list on Paramount.com. And when you click on the movie title, the movie comes up and you can watch it. It's a great tool. And she did an amazing job on that. So we give her props for that. And anybody who really wants to watch it's amazing how much Paramount has in its library. It's just amazing movies from Top Gun to Officer and Gentleman to The Graduate to Sunset Boulevard. To, I mean, just so many great movies on there. And I've been devouring those old movies as I went here and just waiting till Thursday nights to watch your show.
What's so sad is on Monday or like Friday, they were doing Godfather 2 on a big screen in Pacific Palisades, and I had tickets to that. I can watch Sunset Boulevard. I probably watch Sunset Boulevard, Godfather, Godfather 2, all three of them at least once a year. Godfather, usually twice.
Yeah. It's incredible when you see just really calm, smart filmmaking that's not feeling rushed, just completely capable, you know, and you're just in a master's hands. It's great. It's a really cool feeling when you're watching it.
What's also interesting to me, going back to some of those old films, which I think do help keep those creative juices going, some of them don't hold, for me, hold the test of time. And I've never been someone to not offer my opinion. For instance, I'd never watched The Maltese Falcon. Right. And I watched it and I was like, doesn't really hold up for me in the slightest. And in the Cameron Crowe book, he talks to Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder says Maltese Falcon is one of his favorite films. I'm like, Billy, I don't know if you've seen that movie recently. It's not so good.
That's so funny. You know who has one of the actual, there's a little trivia, who actually has one of the prop Maltese Falcons?
Who?
Steve Wynn. He owns one of them. And it's very heavy, by the way. It's like a real, like lead prop. It's not a wood fake prop. It's pretty impressive.
Peter Benedict has one of the eggs from Risky Business.
Oh, that is really cool. Is it cracked or pre-cracked or uncracked?
I think it's pre-cracked.
All right, on. Cool. Well, Marty, thank you very much. Normally, I would ask you, as you know, best day on set. But what I've taken to asking people during this time, especially for you, because you were sick, what's been the best thing you've seen during this crisis?
In terms of
anything you want, in terms of, or if you've seen something super inspirational, or a friend has done something that's blown you away, just kind of your first instinct of like, what's kind of the best thing you've seen?
Well, I guess it would have to be those personal connections that you make during times of crisis. So, you know, the worst day of everybody's life prior to what's gone on now was probably, for at least my generation, was probably 9/11. And the weird part about 9/11 afterwards was the connection you felt with everybody around you and the trauma that all of you shared together. And I remember that being, I wished I could feel that close to the people around me all the time. I wished it didn't take some sort of cataclysmic event. And then cut to the COVID virus. And while I was first cooped up in the attic, you know, every day I had people reaching out, a lot of people that I didn't know I was that close to, but seemed genuinely concerned. And food started to show up at the house, lots of food and lots of connective tissue. And then I had to leave both my family and my friends to get the fuck away and try to hopefully, you know, kick this thing once and for all. And, you know, coming up, I was talking to my wife on the phone, coming up Kenter, turning onto my street, which happened to be, I got the at 12 o'clock at night. I woke up Wednesday morning, and at 12 o'clock the night before, I had gotten a doctor's note saying I did not have the virus anymore. And as I'm driving up Tualatin and pulling in.
Do you want to just give everybody your address, by the way?
Yeah, sure.
But as I turned left into the driveway.
My family was doing a giant Zoom at 1 o'clock for my son's fifth birthday, and I didn't think I was going to be there. And I literally pulled in at 12:45, and my son and my daughter and my other son were running out to the street to say hi to me. And it just reminds you the things that you value.
Yeah, we all got, because I live right by you, we all got evacuated in December too. I mean, it's just been a weird time. We were evacuated for the fires here in Brentwood. It's been a weird year, and Kobe dying. It's just been a real time to reflect on what's important. And I agree with you. And the thing that has been surprising me and I'm feeling that people are genuinely saying and feeling is kind of signing off every call with, be safe, man. Be healthy. Stay healthy. I mean, I think people really are concerned and care about people in a way that isn't just the bullshit. How you feeling? And, you know, fine. All right, moving on. I mean, people are really genuinely wanting to know how people are doing. And that's amazing. And I also feel just in terms of the way that content will probably move is more towards that, more towards like human stories and connective stories and stories of family and relationships and connection. And because we're all craving that right now.
I always say that my superpower is I know how to make women cry. And
wait, what? You might want to hold on.
It's just the truth.
Wow.
But I mean the positive version of making women
cry. Okay, good. Let's just make sure we clear on that.
To your point, I like to watch films and television that move and elicit a response. And if more of us are leaning towards that way so that the types of movies that I want to get made can get made, fantastic.
Me too, man. I'm telling you, I was speaking to Neil on this podcast, and he was just talking about Sonic, man. How many people have just called him and saying, wow, thank you. I had something fun to watch with my family and a couple hours of respite from this thing and just to be able to see your kids laugh and or just be able to sit down with your family and have a good cry. There's nothing like it. It's why I do it for sure.
What I love is, of course, Neil's going to find a way to plug his project.
he deserves it. Yeah, the movie's great. And it's a huge success. My brother, thank you, man. I love you. I'm glad you are feeling better. I'm glad you are healthy. I'm obviously very, very happy for all your success, man. Thank you. And thank you.
You too, buddy. And thanks for doing this. I think everybody loves having a podcast in the middle of all this. So thank you.
Man. Thanks, man. And I'll hopefully see you later today for Zoom Tales, as they call them.
Done.
Okay. Bye, brother.
Bye.